Well, good evening, and let me just add a quick note. I thank Tim for mentioning the CD, and I'm very, very serious about it. As I said on Sunday, I am anxious that believers will come to grips with the life of Jesus, and I think it's much neglected, and it is certainly the most important narrative in all of human history, and it's there for us in the Scriptures, but for various reasons, it's woefully neglected, and there are undoubtedly better tellings, but that's one telling of the story as it's unfolded in Scripture. And if you can put that to use, I'd love to have you take it. Well, we are telling that story, and we have come to Sunday evening, actually. This is the narrative as we laid it out. We said that, in fact, this week of 8 days, Sunday to Sunday, triumphal entry to resurrection, there was careful preparation made. And we tried to identify some of the ways in which Jesus laid the foundation. But you remember the outline that I suggested to you is that Sunday, well, I guess I don't have it here. Sunday is a day of messianic, what, do you remember? Presentation. And the reason we call it that is quite clearly that on that Sunday, on that Palm Sunday, Jesus officially, deliberately, dramatically presented himself in fulfillment of three distinct lines of Old Testament prophecy, right? Presented himself as Messiah. It is the moment of messianic presentation when Jesus rides into the city. And, of course, the psalm that was penned by God, that is by the psalmist as God's the Spirit superintended him, taught men to cry out, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." This is the day, remember that, which the Lord has made. Only God could make this happen, provide this deliverer. We will rejoice and be glad in it. Hoshana. And as we saw, by reason of Jesus' very careful orchestration, if you don't mind, by reason of the fact, you know, I got to tell you, I don't have to, but I will real quickly. When I was doing my doctoral work, I had to submit a dissertation topic. Well, I wanted to do it on this sort of thing. I didn't, because I couldn't talk my props into it, to be honest with you. But Harold Hooner. But I mean, I could talk him into it, but he didn't. It's a long story. But when I submitted it, they really struggled. I was arguing that in so many ways, Jesus, what's the word I want? Kind of orchestrated the events of his own passion. And I don't mean by some sort of ultimate sovereign manipulation that turns men into some sort of robots, and they were just, he just carefully arranged things. What word can you use? I mean, I really worked it. They didn't like the word orchestrate. Matter of fact, it came back to me because I got the syllabus in and they accepted it. And the title they gave me was Jesus' Role in the Events of His Own Passion. Well, that didn't, I mean, it wouldn't have been the same without him. Let's put it that way. You know, that didn't exactly speak to it. But I kind of land on that word orchestrate. And the point is that, remember how we talked about the journey that he took, how he raised Lazarus from the dead and then went and hid himself in Ephraim as a fugitive, John 11:57. And then Luke 17:11 set out and passed through Samaria and then Galilee and fell in with that band of Passover pilgrims and makes his way down for several days, but then 6 days before the Passover, right, John 12? Stops and lets them, what, and stop, goes down to Bethany, outside the Sabbath zone, and lets the crowd go into the city. And thus, that crowd, on Friday afternoon, the Bible is explicit, John 12:1, that Jesus came to Jerusalem, well, came to Bethany 6 days before the Passover, and that's Friday evening, and now they go into the city bearing that message, alert the city, and the city erupts in excitement when Jesus does, in fact, send his disciples up to Bethphage to fetch that donkey and then rides over the brow of the hill and into the city. By the way, if you trace the narrative, it seems like that's about all that happened on that day. It seems to have taken him most of the day just to make his way down into the city. And what the Bible says is, and if you can, well, it'd take me a while to walk you through the geography, but the main entrance to the temple is from the south. And so most likely, Jesus made his way down the valley, down the Kidron, and then into one of the southern entrances to the city, and then up to, and the Bible simply says, he went into the temple, looked around, and returned to Bethany. So that was pretty much the day, with all the excitement, but the whole city was abuzz. And I said to you last night, I think in closing, that there is a legitimate question, and it's a question to which I think a lot of horribly deficient answers are given. There is a legitimate question as to how in the world Jesus could get away with this. How anybody in this day of Roman rule, when the Romans were so sensitive to counterfeit kings and pretender kings. Now, in this case, it wasn't a counterfeit king, but he was a pretender king, so he was claiming the kingly office. Remember I said to you that Jesus was wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove? A couple of ways that just occurred to me that I ought to mention to you, not explicitly in your notes, but in which Jesus was, in fact, wise as a serpent. I'm reading a book, and it's a fascinating book. It's called Are You the One Who Should Come? And it's a whole book given to the issue of what is called Jesus' messianic self-understanding. There's a huge debate as to whether or not Jesus ever conceived himself as Messiah. Can you believe that? Out of the pages of the Gospel. Now the reason, the sole reason for that debate is that Jesus, in fact, does not refer to himself as Messiah. There is one time during his public ministry, before his arrest, when he does take to himself, it's coming out of somebody else's mouth, but he embraces the title Messiah. Do you remember where that is? You all remember when I tell you, but it's a curveball question. It's the woman at the well. Remember, she says, I know that the Jews believe that Messiah is soon to come. And Jesus says what? The one speaking to you is He. Now that's the only time. It's in Samaria. Remember what we talked about last night? That Samaria is very, very, the Jews don't live there. That's the only time He ever takes the title to Himself. And out of that, for that reason, there are many. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you something, beyond the world of Bible believers, the whole academic community, that community of skeptical, critical New Testament scholars, universally have insisted, let's say it that way, that it was the church that imposed upon the Nazarene this notion of Messiahship, that he never claimed it for himself. Now, I spent too long introducing. The point is, it's true that but you know why? It is so circumspect. It is wise as a serpent, because had Jesus gone about, what does Messiah, Mashiach, what does it mean to a Jewish ear? It means a lot, but it certainly means king. And Rome was, in fact, not in the mood to tolerate pretender kings. And remember that Rome was a heavy-handed overlord, and at every corner of their empire at this season or that, there was, in fact, some seditionist, some rebel who rose up and got a little following and tried to establish himself as king, and Rome would not tolerate it. We'll talk tomorrow night, probably, about the dynamics of crucifixion and how unspeakably cruel it was and how deliberately it was designed to last a long time. And the reason is because it was specifically designed to put down rebellion. They fine-tuned that mode of execution in order to discourage rebellion, not only in the heart of the person hanging there who has ceased to be much of a problem to him, but all the passers-by who might have some seditious impulse in their hearts. Does that make sense to you? So the point is, if Jesus had simply all throughout his ministry gone from place to place saying, I am your Messiah, I am your King, he would have armed his enemies, he would have alerted the Romans, and things would have short-circuited very early. But what did Jesus do? And this is what the scholars uniformly overlook. What he did is, he took to himself Old Testament titles. What's his favorite title for himself? Son of Man. Where's that come from? Daniel 7. When the Ancient of Days takes his seat and the Son of Man appears before him and is dispatched to establish a kingdom which will endure forever. He takes titles. He takes passages. Remember in the synagogue in Nazareth in Luke chapter 4 when he was asked to participate in the service, and they handed him the Isaiah scroll, and he read from Isaiah 61, then he sat down, as was appropriate, and began to teach, and what did he say? He reads one of the most messianic, nobody questions whether Isaiah 61 is a messianic passage. What does he do? What does he say when he sits down? This day, this scripture is fulfilled in your ears. He takes figures, he takes passages, he takes titles to himself again and again, which to any Jewish listener cannot be mistaken. He is claiming to be Messiah and understand him, but he is disarming his enemies. I mean, late in his ministry, and this gets a little complicated, but when he's before the Sanhedrin, and they say, tell us plainly, that's the idea, tell us. Don't beat around the bush, tell us, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Living God? This is in Luke. And Jesus says, no, I misspoke, but he says, are you the Messiah? And Jesus says, I'll not tell you, but I'll tell you this. You're going to see me, the Son of Man, coming in the clouds of heaven. Now, and that scene, we're going to talk about it tomorrow night, Jesus' enemies, the Sanhedrinists, Pharisees and Sadducees together now, were trying to get him to indict himself, to implicate himself. And so they were trying to get him to say out loud in the presence of witness, I am Messiah. He didn't do that. He said, you're going to see me, the Son of Man. Now, had he said, I am Messiah King, they'd have gone straight to Pilate and said, you got a problem here, this is Passover, you got to worry, this man claims to be a king. But they can't go to Pilate and say, this man claims to be the Son of Man, he's going to come in the clouds of glory. You know what I'm saying? Pilate goes, I don't know what you're talking about. It is so careful. It is so clever. Now, another way in which Jesus showed himself, and what I'm after here, and the reason I take the time, I mean, I think it's important, and these are important elements of the narrative as a whole, but I'll tell you something. As I said to you the first morning, I am so anxious for you to come really to grips in terms of the narrative with a real human life that Jesus is living. And he can't simply go whistling through this week. He is in great danger at all times. And one of the things that he does that is so clever is he stays in Bethany. Because, you see, Bethany is just outside the city of Jerusalem, but it's just off a main road. And it's Passover season. And you're going to have hundreds of people constantly in and out of the city. And so Jesus falls in with those people, and he is the hero of those people. And thus, remember how many times the Bible says, matter of fact, take your Bible real quickly and go to Luke 19. But this theme is reiterated again and again. That his enemies, his very, very powerful and committed enemies, desperately wanted to arrest him and be done with him. But they couldn't. And the reason they couldn't, and that appeal is made to this again and again, is because of the people. Luke 19 and verse 47 and 48, he was teaching daily in the temple. Now this is during the period that we're talking about, the Passion Week. The chief priests, the scribes, the leaders of the people sought to destroy him. They were unable to do anything, for all the people were very attentive to hear him. Remember what we talked about before? Every Roman officer had two basic responsibilities: collect the taxes, keep the peace. Jesus is a wildly popular folk hero. That popularity is self-serving, it's superficial, it's thin as a water on a plate, as doctors say. But the fact is that his enemies knew if they just tried to scoop him up and haul him off, the people would riot. There was a riot, the Romans would send troops, and they'd look for who caused the riot, and their heads would roll. Does that make sense to you? But my point is, this is another little nicety of the culture that is good for you to understand. In Jewish culture, hospitality is very, very much an obligation. But when you offer a person, and it's more than having them over for coffee, that's nice too, help yourself. But it means providing for them in times of need, when they're traveling, when they're sick, whatever. But whenever you give a person hospitality, you take him into your home, you are wholly obligated to protect him. He becomes your obligation. That's your obligation. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. That's the whole thought there. Well, Jesus is cherished in Bethany. Bethany's just outside the city of Jerusalem. But every night, he makes his way out there in the presence of the crowds, into Bethany, where they love him dearly. And the Sanhedrinists know they're not going to be able to whisk him out of there. And then in the morning, he joins in with these crowds going into the city. Does that make sense to you? You got to see that Jesus' movements are carefully planned. And they are planned you know, against the background. I mean, given the fact that he is in such serious danger. Well, all that, I lose my way. The point is that on Sunday, Jesus cleanses the temple. He rides into the city in his triumphal entry, and then he goes into the temple, looks around, Mark says, and returns to Bethany. Some have stumbled over that, and they've said, well, now wait a minute. Why did he wait until the next morning when he returned to cleanse the temple? Well, again, I'll say two things. Have you ever heard that? Some people will argue that. And usually where they're headed is that Matthew and Mark have competing stories and so on, but they're traditions. But the fact is, number one, that which was most offensive in the temple probably quieted down by the afternoon. And it was the evening, it says specifically. In other words, the money changers and all that sort of thing probably quieted down. And it might, but I think the other thing is, I do not believe, we're going to talk about it in just a moment, I do not believe for a minute that the cleansing of the temple was a matter of momentary pique, some fit of anger, some horror that swelled. I think it was very carefully planned. And I think it had to happen on Monday morning for very, very important reasons. And I'll talk to you about it in just a moment. So, Sunday, a day of messianic presentation. Now this evening, I want us to talk about Monday and Tuesday together. And I call them days of messianic proclamation. And I'm not going to spend too much time with the PowerPoint, but I have to in a moment. I'll get there. I give you kind of an overview of what's going to happen on that day. But here we go. These are the days that the way we're kind of following the outline. So, Sunday, the triumphal entry, a day of messianic presentation, very, very deliberate. I left you with a question last night. What's the question? Given Sunday, why Friday, right? Given the fact that the city was so anxious to accept Jesus as king, throwing down their garments, singing the hosannas and so on, why on Friday is that same city? And everybody who studies the Passion Week struggles with this question. And generally the answer is that it's a different crowd. But it's not a different crowd. Some people will say that by Friday morning, most of the people had gone home and so the pilgrims were gone. But they wouldn't have gone home. Passover was Thursday night. For me, and we'll talk about that as well. So the point is that it's the same crowd. All right. Here's the question, and I want to give myself this evening as we study Monday and Tuesday to answering this question. I kind of adumbrated it last night. Given Sunday, why Friday? And I would suggest to you the answer is Monday and Tuesday. I think this is so careful and deliberate. Now, in that regard, you have in the front of your notes this series of 10 what I call insights into the life of Jesus. And I pointed them out to you and said it might be helpful just to read them over. But I want you to look at number 6. Because this is what is at stake. I'm going to read it to you. Number 6 in those important insights. And I say there, throughout his ministry, Jesus employed a remarkable strategy to unmask the superficial and hypocritical nature of the public adulation paid him by the multitudes. Now, I said to you the other day that by reason of the fact that he cleansed the temple at the very beginning of his ministry, Jesus was catapulted immediately into the status of wildly popular folk hero. Remember that? The whole land was... And folks, he's going about... every indication in the Gospels is that if you had any infirmity and you got to Jesus, he never ever healed groups. You had to get to him. If you did, you were healed. Now, if you had some infirmity, if a loved one had some infirmity, what would you do? So you can imagine the crowds that everywhere he went, these huge crowds. Furthermore, he is, after all, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, he is the best show in town. I mean, it's not often that you have this much excitement, a man doing miracles and making these claims and confronting the Pharisaic leadership and so on. So this is a dramatic thing. And so everywhere he goes, he's wildly popular. Well, matter of fact, I think I say it here. Number 6 there. I say, this was his strategy. All right. I should make it clear. You and I are both going to insist. We recognize that popularity, as I say, was horribly superficial, right? It was self-serving. It was not genuine saving faith by any means. Now, how did he unmask it? And it's not all that complicated, but it's such a habit of his that I want you to see it. As I say there in the middle of that number six there, when confronted by shallow pseudo offers of acceptance. Now, it's going to happen a number of times that people are going to cry out. At one time in John 6 and verse 15, after the feeding of the 5,000, the Bible says, I don't even know what this looks like. It says they tried to take him by force and make him king. Remember that? I mean, it's as if they were just going to drag him off somewhere and stick a crown in his head or something, you know, in spite of himself. So there were plenty of times where the nation seemed, and one of them was the triumphal entry. I would suggest we're going to discover that that's a pseudo offer. Can I use that word of repentance, of acceptance? They seem to be offering. So I say it again. When confronted by shallow pseudo offers of acceptance, he would always speak hard words. Words which, not I mean confusing words, I mean words which made the choice tough. He would put his finger right on the rawest, most, you know, sensitive nerve in your spiritual body. And he'd say, that's what I demand, again and again. So words which demanded a choice, the morally right choice being indicative of obedience and belief, but also involving a serious price to be paid by the one making that choice. Now notice, if you will, on that statement, usually, or as often as not, this demand was that they reject the Pharisees in order to accept his claims. This dynamic that the Pharisees were, well, let me go a little further. And I'll come back to it. My point is, let me just say this for now. I'm arguing, given Sunday, why Friday? The answer is Monday and Tuesday. And Monday and Tuesday are two of the most remarkable days in all of human history. This is absolutely stunning. The drama is overwhelming. I think if you came to me with your newly invented time machine and gave me one free ticket, I think I'd dial up Monday and Tuesday. This is absolutely stunning what happens on these two days. But when all the dust settles, Jesus has driven this nation to a decision. And that's where I want you to see. Now, let me just walk you through it. The events of the day... I'm doing way too much here. Yipes. You know what? Hold on here, you guys. Hold on. Forgive me. I think I'm the wrong place on my... I am... I'm so embarrassed. Here's where I want to be. Yeah, do that one. Yeah, well, you know what? I can plug it in, too. And the clicker, I think, is right here somewhere. I don't know why mine gave up the ghost so quick. Maybe the battery. Okay, here we go. This is where I meant to be. There's probably my hotel.
There it is.
No, that's not.
Here it is.
Ah, what a guy. What a guy. Let's see if this one will work, huh? Oh, I forgot. Okay. The Keystone Cops give a lecture. You know what I'm saying? All right. Here we go. Stay with me now. So Monday and Tuesday, days of Messianic proclamation. This is where I want to go. I'm going to walk through most of the events very, very quickly. As I say, Jesus and the disciples are staying with Lazarus in Bethany. On Monday morning, he gets up and he comes into the city and goes to the temple and begins teaching. Along the way, he encounters this fig tree. I talked about it under another context. You know what, though? This is, we're kind of a class here. And we can be here till 11 o'clock, right? No, I'm not. Here's the interesting thing. I want to do something with you. Go to Matthew chapter... you know, I have told you before, I want the fig tree, so it's going to be Matthew 19, a little further. 21. Matthew 21. Now, folks, this is a little bit of an aside, but I think it's important. I mentioned to you before that there's a whole community of so-called scholars who live to prove the Bible wrong, right? And their happy hunting ground is, in fact, the Gospels, and even more so the Passion Week. And here's one of the places where they say, Matthew and Mark's telling of the stories is just entirely different. There's contradiction. You can't, no, there aren't. But you, watch. In Matthew, it simply says this. I'm going to read it to you. Matthew chapter 21. And It's in verse 18. Now, I want you to notice something. In verses 12 to 17, he has the narrative of the cleansing of the temple. Are you with me? And that happened on Monday. And then he says in verse 18, in the morning, as he returned to the city, he was hungry. And seeing a fig tree by the road, he came to it and found nothing on but leaves, and said to it, let not fruit grow on you ever again. Immediately the fig tree withered again. And when the disciples saw it, they marveled, saying, how did the fig tree wither away so soon? And Jesus said, if you had faith, you could move mountains. All right. Now you read that, and you come away with the impression that that all happened at once. Am I right about that? The fig tree was cursed. It withered. They saw it. And then Jesus gave his lesson. Is that the impression you get? And furthermore, you get the impression that it happened on Tuesday. I mean, by our reckoning here, if the cleansing of the fig tree, I'm sorry, the cleansing of the temple was on Monday, and it says in verse 18, in the morning. Now I'll go over to Mark. Mark chapter 11. No. Hold on here, I'll find it. Mark 11, yeah, and verse... Now, I want you to notice something. You have in Mark 11... Are you with me? We're doing a little exercise here. We are harmonizing. That's what we're doing here, folks. We're harmonizing the Gospels. In Mark 11, verses 1 to 11, you have the story of the triumphal entry. That's Sunday. And then it says in verse 12, now the next day. So what's that? That's Monday. When they had come out from Bethany, he was hungry, seeing the fig tree, had leaves, he went, found no leaves, and cursed it. Then he tells in verse 15 the story of the cleansing of the temple. See that? That's Monday. Then in verse 20 it says, now in the morning as they passed by. So Mark makes it clear that it was on Monday that the fig tree was cursed, and it was on Tuesday they found it withered. And so again, the critical community is screaming and yelling, say there's an error, there's a contradiction. Matthew clearly puts it on Tuesday, and he puts it all in one day. All right, now, here's the thing. This is where, number one, the harmonizing effort... You know what? I admit that I approach this question with a presupposition. I believe the Bible is inerrant. Now, the critic approaches it with his presupposition, too. I just like my presuppositions better than his, but the idea that any of us comes with a white sheet of paper is a whole bunch of nonsense, right? On the other hand... Let's be honest with the text. Number one, understand this, that Matthew, of all four Gospels, by anybody's assessment, Matthew is the least concerned about strict chronology. He groups things quite often, unapologetically. That doesn't take away from the factuality or the accuracy. If he had said it happened the next day, and it only happened, and it really happened 2 days, or whatever, then it would be, but if he doesn't give us a hard time reference, that makes sense to you? Alright, I'm not making sense, but go back to Matthew. Let's reread Matthew, forgive me. Matthew 21. He tells the story of the cleansing of the temple, which happened on Monday, and then he says in verse 18, now in the morning. Honest to goodness, folks, does he say the next morning? You see, here's the thing. The Jews don't eat in the morning. The cycle of the day among the Jewish people is rather different from our own. It's a hot sun, and so even to this day, they tend to be up early and busy as the sun comes up. And then when the sun reaches gets hot in the middle of the day, about 10 o'clock in the morning, they break and they go in and have a meal. Does that make sense to you? So they don't begin the meal of the day with a meal. That makes sense to you? And so what he is saying here, and by the way, when they do go in and have a meal, before they do, there's an extended time of prayer. Because it's at that point that back in Jerusalem, the morning sacrifice is being offered. We think of the evening and morning sacrifice as first thing in the morning and last thing in the evening. No. The morning happens about 10 o'clock in the morning. And then they take the middle of the day kind of to be quiet and study or rest or whatever, or do things in the shade. And then when the sun gets past its apex and you start to get the Mediterranean breezes, they return to the field. But just before they do, you have the evening sacrifice. So that's the cycle by which they live. Does that make sense to you? Now, Matthew is simply saying in Matthew 21, It was in the morning, it's an explanation as to why he was hungry. Because the Jews do not begin the day with a meal, but they often begin the day with a snack. Remember the disciples rubbing the grain and so on and getting the, is exactly the same thing. So it doesn't say it was the morning after the triumphal entry, or after the cleansing of the temple at all. All it says is it was in the morning. And that's an kind of important element to the story, because you need to understand that that's the way the Jews live. Does that make sense to you? Honest to goodness, that's all it says. And it's entirely accurate, and it's important to the story. And furthermore, verse 20, it says, when the disciples saw it. Does it say that they saw it immediately after it happened? No. Now, there is absolutely not one single point of contradiction between what Matthew says and what Mark says. Mark helps us, because if we had only Matthew to read, we would think it happened on Tuesday morning all at once. I don't know that our theology or our eschatology or whatever would be horribly crippled by that misimpression. But we do have Matthew to give us a little finer understanding of the chronology of the events. Does that make sense to you? The point is that again and again this happens. That there will be some perceived discrepancy when you read the text carefully. Have I satisfied your soul spirit here? Honest to goodness, do you see what I'm saying to you? We're not sucking anything out of our thumbs. We're not trying to get anything out of the text that isn't there. But on the other hand, we're not finding things in the text which aren't there, which is often done. Well, I lose my way entirely. The point is that you have that event on Monday morning of the fig tree. I'll just say this. I think that in Jesus' mind, the fig tree so marvelously represented Israel. He had ridden into town yesterday. The whole city had thrown down their garments. And he knew how self-serving that was. He knew how shallow that was. In other words, it was all leaves. And he was going to prove before 2 days were over that there was no fruit. And therefore, there was going to be a curse. And I think the fig tree... I'll say one other thing. I'm teaching Life of Christ all of a sudden. I don't have time for this. But it always occurs to me that a lot of people get offended at this. And they say, now, wait a minute. These fig trees belong to somebody. It was against the law, rabbinical law, to have a tree just growing. The soil was very, very sparse in Judea. And you could not have a tree, a fruit tree, that didn't bear fruit for more than 3 years. You had to dig it up. Now, very possibly this was just that sort of a tree. And have you ever seen a fig tree? You know what a fig tree looks like? They're gnarly buzzards. You know what I'm saying? They're hard to get out of the ground. It takes, you know, several men a day and a half. And I think maybe this was a tree which it wasn't bearing fruit. It was, and I think probably the owner was pretty happy. I'm just making that up, but I think very possibly the owner was, you know, hey, I got a couple others. You want to, you know, I can't get out of the ground. But maybe his neighbors were asking for help in this regard. But all that having been said, the point to be made is on Monday morning, Mark is clear, as Jesus comes into town with his disciples from Bethany, as was the habit of the Jewish people. And by the way, what he goes to find are what are called the winter figs. Because figs grow in Israel in the summer and are harvested in the fall. But there is a winter fig that comes late in the season. It's gnarly, it's unharvestable, it's kind of dirty. But there's a little bit of meat on it. And so you're welcome to pluck it and to grind that little meat out and get a snack out of it. Does that make sense to you? But those figs always come before the summer leaves. So if it's got leaves, you ought to be able to count on it that it's got fruit. But this was a barren tree, evidently. And so when he gets there, it's got the leaves, big show, but no fruit. And therefore, he curses it. And it's the next morning that his disciples are following the same path, coming in from Bethany just as before, and they, wow, look at that fig tree, it's withered from the roots up. And Jesus applies the lesson. Well, more importantly, well, I say, who am I to say, but let me take it to the cleansing of the temple. This is huge. I said to you the other day, and I'm going to review it very, very quickly, but in the first place, you need to understand something of the abuses that are at stake here. This is a drawing of the temple that Jesus knew. Now listen, how many temples has Israel had? Two. The first one was built by and destroyed by Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. The second one, go to the head of the class, was built by, under the head of the leadership of, it was Zerubbabel. That's good. If you know Zerubbabel, you know your Old Testament, I always say. And it was destroyed by Rome in A.D. 70. Now, here's the thing. That second temple had two very distinct stages, because as it was first constructed on that barren hillside, or hilltop, under the leadership of Zerubbabel in Ezra 1-6, it was a hideous disappointment compared to Solomon. As a matter of fact, I love that verse in Ezra 3, where telling the story, Ezra says, the scribe Ezra writing this history, says that when they, you know, they came back from they paid the price and they answered God's call and they left the Babylon where the living was good, and they came all the way across the Fertile Crescent with money, of course, that the Persian monarch had taken from the coffers. But and first thing they had to do was scrape the rubble off the Temple Mount from Nebuchadnezzar's destruction. And then they charted exactly where the temple should be, and they laid out the foundation. Then they figured out where the altar should be, and they constructed the altar, and they said, well, let's go ahead and start sacrifices. And when they did, and remember, most of these people, I'm back in Ezra chapter 1 to 6, 538. Most of those people who had come back had lived their whole lives in Persia, in Babylon. And they never sacrificed. They never had an opportunity to obey. You can imagine their Bible studies as they went through Leviticus, and imagine the delights of serving God in that fashion. But they never do it. So now they come back and they get everything set up, and they start to they offer sacrifices once again. And Ezra says this. I love this verse. He says that they began to weep with joy, and then he goes on to say that there were many of them who were older, white hairs. He calls them. And you're not even that old, but it's your dad's fault. I'm sorry. There were some who were old enough to remember Solomon's temple, and they also began to weep, and they wept because this was such a disappointing, horribly humble, almost humiliating edifice. I lost the word for a minute. It was so disappointing. And this is what Ezra says in Ezra 3:3, that you couldn't tell who was weeping for joy and who was weeping for sorrow, which is the restoration period in a nutshell. Now the point is that Zerubbabel constructed this second temple, which was on any level, by any standard, was horribly disappointing. By the way, they got careless. Remember, they came back, they got to work, and then they got careless, and God raised up two prophets to get them back to the business of building the temple. I'm in the Old Testament all of a sudden. But you remember who those two prophets were? We got them both in the Bible. Haggai. Nehemiah. It's during the days of Ezra. Haggai and Zechariah. And one of those two prophets, Zechariah, made a remarkable prophecy. And he prophesied returning Jews. He said, the glory of this house will be greater than the glory of the latter house. And what happened is that a man came along named Herod the Great. And Herod was made by the Romans, who had by now subjugated the entire Mediterranean world, including Israel, in 63 B.C. But Herod was made king in 40 B.C. and took possession of his kingdom in 37 B.C. And Herod built this. It is one of the most amazing engineering feats in all of human history. It staggers us. There are elements of this building. There are engineering elements of this building that we could not duplicate today. We don't know how he did it, and I don't. There is a. All right, I'm going to get too deeply into this, but you got to understand that temple right there is sitting on a little tiny knob of a hill that at one time was the threshing floor of Arabnah. Remember that? David possessed this city down here. He went up north. There was a plague. The plague was stopped by an angel at the threshing floor of Arabnah. And then he went and bought that little threshing floor. Now, threshing floor is by definition where you go and throw the wheat in the ground, in the air, and let the chaff blow off. You know, you want it a little round hill. It's just a little round hill. In order to take, now Solomon had leveled it out, and quite frankly, Hezekiah after Solomon had leveled it out some, but Herod wanted to build a huge, beautiful temple. I'll tell you something. This has nothing to do with it. Well, it does, but... See, Herod, number one, Herod became king in Judea at a remarkable time. It was the Pax Romana. Remember that? The Roman peace. Remember Augustus or Octavian, the Caesar? And he had established... And trade was exploding. And one of the most remarkable and important little tiny factoids about the land of Israel is that it's the only narrow spot on the most important international highway in the ancient world. The only narrow spot. And so if you possess that land, you can control all the military and commercial traffic, and more importantly to Herod, you can tax it. You can put a toll. So Herod, number one, do you remember this? He built a harbor in Israel. Israel, even though, have you ever thought about this? Israel has a long seacoast. Can you picture it in your mind, the land of Israel? They've never gone to sea. Right north of them is Phoenicia. They've always gone to sea. Why did Israel never go to sea? They have no harbor. Remember the tons of silt that are dumped out of the Nile River every day? Every year, all these tons of silt, all the currents wash it right up along the Israeli coast, so it's wiped clean. And so you don't have any place where you've got an outcropping of rocks which is significant enough that the ships can pull in, because these are sail-driven ships. And if they're up against the shore and a storm comes along and they can't get out to sea and it can happen quickly, there's no more ship, and they won't do it. So Israel never had a harbor. But Herod wanted to be a first-rate Roman. Herod was given the little land of Judea, which was by any measure a horribly humble little third-rate outpost. And he wanted to transform it into one of the greatest Roman provinces. And he did. And the first thing he did is build a beautiful harbor at a place called Caesarea Maritima. If you haven't been there, you need to get there. It's absolutely remarkable. He figured out, he found a concrete that would set up underwater, and he devised a means of building forms on the water and then pouring them full of the concrete and then putting ballast and sinking them to the bottom of the sea. And he built a huge harbor that stood for centuries and was very, very effective. And so this becomes, and by the way, just to the north of Israel was Tyre. Remember that? That's a seaport. Just to the south of Israel was Alexandria. Remember that? That's a seaport. Well, there's a lot of trade that was going right through Israel and heading down to Alexandria, and he seized all, he got all of that. Now he's getting, he's making so much money he can't get rid of it. By reason of taxing the caravans coming through and taxing the spice trade as it makes its way to his harbor that he's built, and people are coming from across the world just to see this. Caesarea is an amazing city. An amazing city. He built it into the side of like a big bowl. And he built it in such a way that underground there were locks. Subterranean locks. So then the tide came in, the water would go up in those locks. And then he had sluice gates. Because in the ancient world, animal dung was a real issue in town. But every night, Caesarea got flushed. It just went right out to sea. And, but here's where I started to tell you all that. That city that he built, Caesarea, which was the capital, that's where he lived, that's where Pontius Pilate lived. And he built a palace you can't believe down there. Herod was very much into building palaces. But the point is, it was a Roman city. It was a pagan, matter of fact, as you sailed into that huge harbor, dominating the harbor was a huge temple to Zeus with a huge statue of Zeus. And then just beyond the harbor was the gymnasium, where they engaged in the games, sans clothes and so on. And then you had the hippodrome, which you can walk through today, where they raced the horses, and you had the theater and the amphitheater and so on. It was totally, totally a pagan city. And to the Jewish people, it was a festering sore. It was a pimple on the face of Israel. They have this huge, and it so angered the Jews that in order to buy back their favor, he consented to do this. And he gave himself to the huge effort. Now, this isn't the only engineer. These aren't the only. But in order to do this, what he did is he took that little knob of a hill, and I don't know if I can explain this, but he built all the way around it on three sides, because on one side there was bedrock, but on the other three sides, north and east and south, he built huge retaining walls. Built them, and see where these fake pillars start? Those are called pilasters. That's the actual temple. Everything down here is that retaining wall system that he built so he could expand the Temple Mount from a little hilltop to about 37 acres. You can get 250,000 people in there at once. It's huge. And most of it is suspended in the air. You go inside down here, hundreds of pillars, about half again as high as this, arches, about half again as high as this building. And in order to build this, by the way, this is the Wailing Wall. Now, you remember that when Rome destroyed this building, they pushed the whole thing into this valley. And they filled the valley up. So today, when you stand at the Wailing Wall, you're actually about 70 feet above. By the way, these are people. And these are shops. Just to give you some feel for the dimensions of this thing. And in order to build this huge retaining wall, and today they've done an archaeological dig, and you can walk all the way up it, all the way up here, right alongside the wall. I always get such a kick out of it. But down there is one ashlar. Now, an ashlar is a carved stone. It was quarried out of the hillside somewhere. And it's probably about two-thirds the length of that wall. It's 10 feet high. It weighs 600 tons. It was quarried somewhere. It was brought to this place and put in place. I stood there with a man whose whole life has been cranes. He was from Seattle, and he was with a group, and his name was Rick. And he spent all his life going off to this part of the world and another and training people on the newest crane technology, you know. And I said, Rick, could you move that from the quarry here? He said, absolutely not. He said, if I had two cranes, I could reposition it, but I could not move it from one place to another. The technology doesn't exist. Herod did it. So the engineering is absolutely amazing. Now, I get all caught up with it, but by the way, I mentioned that the primary entrance was to the south. These are those two primary entrances. There were two more like it over here, and they're called the Hulda Gates. You ascended these 15 steps. Why 15? Can you think? No, there are 15 psalms. That's what you're thinking of, though. The Psalms of Ascent, Psalm 120 to 34. Sometime you want an interesting intellectual, not intellectual so much, spiritual exercise. Get up early on the Sunday morning and before you come to church, just quietly, contemplatively, read through those 15 psalms. They're God's way of preparing your heart for worship. And so you would stop on each one of these psalms. By the way, these stairs are still there today. You can stand on those stairs. And you would stand on the first one and read the 120th psalm, then go to the next. And during feast seasons and so on, the Levitical choirs would be arranged here, and you'd do an antiphonally. You would read part of it, and they would sing back to you, and then you'd step the next step and so on. But it was all designed. But, by the way, I got to tell you one other thing. I don't have to, but I'm going to, aren't I? You'd go in here, and it was a subterranean passage. Well, obviously underground. It was all very, very beautiful and huge, but it was dark and lit by torches and so on. And then you would emerge right here. And the ramp would come up. And now you got to understand that this over here is east. This is west. So this is south. So you go in this passageway here, and you make your way through the dark tunnel. What's happening to your eyes, right? They're dilating, you know, they're getting wide. And then you emerge here, and the sun is behind you. And here is this 90-foot temple overlaid with ivory and gold, and it's glittering in the sun. And Josephus says it would almost physically knock you over as you emerged and saw that, because that's God's house. That's where God lives. And you ought to understand that the sacred place, and it was constructed the whole experience. I'll tell you, this whole apparatus was designed. I'm going to make this point again Thursday night, but this whole apparatus was designed to assault your physical senses. The whole experience just assaulted your physical senses. God was totally unabashed about that. He intended for this to be a life-changing experience, to come up to temple. Does that make sense to you? Now, having said it, here's the rub, and this is what I got to talk about, and we got to hurry. At Passover season, everyone had to have a lamb. Most people didn't bring a lamb. You could. It just had to be, you could not have, it couldn't be a gift. You couldn't have stolen it, obviously. It had to be a genuine, it had to be a sacrifice. Remember Doc Clearwaters? He used to tell you the difference between, remember this, Grant? An offering and a sacrifice. It says a pig and a chicken were making their way down the road one day, and they saw a sign that said, benefit breakfast, ham and eggs, bacon and eggs. And the chicken said, we ought to make a contribution. And the pig said, for you it's a contribution, for me it's a sacrifice. As we used to say. Remember Doc saying that? But anyway, my point is that the lamb had to be a sacrifice. The lamb had, and you had to pay market price for it. Well, shepherds all year long would bring their sheep up to this region and sell you along the way. But at Passover, you had to have a lamb and you had to present it to the priest. Remember that? It had to be presented to the priest at least 4 days, and then for 4 days, before Passover, and 4 days, it had to be with you. Well, the priests at this time were horribly corrupt. And they realized that there was money to be made here. Now, who is the high priest when Jesus is tried and executed? Do you remember his name? Caiaphas. Caiaphas's father-in-law was Annas. Annas had been high priest for many years. He was so corrupt, the Romans had put him out, but he had finagled three of his sons and then his son-in-law into the office, and now Caiaphas is the high priest. What I'm about to tell you is remembered in Josephus as Annas's bazaar, because Annas learned to make himself filthy rich and the priests filthy rich. And all they did was make it clear that they wouldn't accept a lamb. Now again, once you have your lamb, you have to take it to the priest. And they wouldn't accept a lamb that hadn't been sold by a shepherd who was giving them a piece of the action. So it was just a kickback thing. Well, of course, that forces up the price of the lambs, and everybody resented it. And evidently, this is a little nebulous, but it seems best to understand that they were having trouble monitoring this and managing it. And so they moved the whole operation inside. Now, this is a model. This is a Second Temple model, 50-to-1 model. But here you have a little better representation. This is the temple proper. The temple was in three stages, courts, concentric. You came into what was called the court of the Gentiles. Anybody was welcome to come that far if you're interested in Yahweh, right? You would go past this low fence right here. And every so many feet on that fence, it was a low fence, about like that, there was a little inscription. And it said, let the Gentile who passes this barrier know that he will be responsible for the death that he will surely experience, or something like that. We found two of them. Not me and my buddy, but, you know, archaeologists found two of them. And they're called Thanatos inscriptions. But anyway, you would go through there, and then through this gate here, you'd come through this, and through this gate, and you would be in what was called the court of the women. This is as far as women and underage Jewish boys could go. But then you would pass through that gate right there, called the Nicanor Gate, very, very beautiful gate, and you would be in this inner court, and that's where the altar is and the laver is. That's the court of Israel. That's where sacrifice actually happens. And then, of course, inside that court is the temple building proper with the holy place and the holy of holies. Does that make sense to you? Well, this outer court had been, this is what Herod had been careful to construct, this huge outer court. And evidently, they had moved the business of selling the sheep inside. Does that make sense to you? Furthermore, in order to afford this, in order to pay for this, Herod had exacted what he called a two-day temple tax. Everybody had to pay 2 days' wages every year, every Jew in the world. And they had kind of a handy, now they actually went out to village to village and collected it, but they also had a list here, and if you came up to temple and your name wasn't on the list, you weren't getting in. But the Sadducees, the priests, agreed to collect that tax on one condition, that is that Herod would demand to be paid in local currency. So now these people, remember this is Passover, and people come from all over the world, and they come in and they want to change money. They have to change money. They don't want it. They have to. And of course, they're going to be charged horribly usurious rates. So the point is, the common man just despised this. But this was the season of the year when the horribly arrogant and aristocratic and wealthy priests fattened their coffers more than any other time. Does that make sense to you? And the people resented it, but you couldn't do anything. You know, I always think, you're just a poor rube. You don't know any better. You've come from a long way away. It's your one time. You planned this a long time, so you're going to go up to the temple, and you get there, and before you get there, here's a shepherd. You buy a lamb. Now, you know Leviticus. You know the requirements. You can look at the lamb. It's a year old. You can go through it. It's not. So you know full well it meets qualifications. Now, on the 10th of Nisan, in all naivete, if you don't mind, you come and you present it to the priest. The priest gives it a very, very quick look, says, nope. No good. What do you mean it's no good? Hey, who's in charge here? I'm telling you, it's no good. You're not going to... Now, there's a booth right over there. And there's a guy, he may have a certain family resemblance. You know, I'm making that part up. But the point is, maybe he'll take yours in trade. So now you go over here, I'm making part of that. You go over, and, you know, you already paid once for the lamb, and now you got to, he gives you a little price, and then you have to pay again. You know, and then you have to pay the temple tax. And very probably, by the way, I think Hophni and Phinehas are an adumbration of this. I really do. The whole Eli and Hophni and Phinehas thing in the Old Testament. And I think very possibly the lamb that you were left with was a defiled lamb. And so now maybe you come all this way, and the lamb that you're sold is really doesn't meet Levitical qualifications, but he's going to accept it because he's only in this for the money. And then I always think maybe as you leave that day, you look back and some other poor one, you know, some other pilgrim is paying big money for the lamb that was just rejected for you, you know, back at that same booth. And the point is you put it all together, and the people absolutely despised it. But what are you going to do? You know, you can't go down the road and start the Second Baptist Temple, I always say. So you're stuck with it. And you're stuck with it, and you're stuck with that priesthood. Now, the point is, there are two times here. I have a couple of the pictures just to make the point. But there are two times here you are looking down on the temple from the Mediterranean side, from the west. Here's the Mount of Olives over here and the Kidron down here. But this is the temple. Here's Solomon's porch and the royal porch and so on. It was a marvelous structure. Well, let me talk about it for just a minute. I've got to talk about something else. We've got to be done. Jesus, again, there are four Passovers in Jesus' ministry. He heals, John chapter 2, he cleanses the temple the first time. I said to you the other day, there is strategy in this. You need to know, do I have it here? Yeah. Let me give you this real quick. You might want to write this down somewhere if you got a blank sheet of paper or something. This is not in your notes specifically. Yeah, you have a lot of blank sheet of paper. Do as you will. But it is really huge to understand the roles of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Like I say, in the Old Testament, you don't have either one. But during the intertestamental period, both of these groups arise, and by the time you open the pages of the Gospel, you've got these two primary Jewish sects or subsects of leadership and so on, and they dominate the culture and they dominate the narrative, and you need to know something about them. So I've broken it down this way. Let's think first of all about the Pharisee. The Pharisees controlled the synagogues. Now, this was a de jure. I'm sorry, it was a de facto thing. In other words, there was never any law that was passed or anything. But the fact is that, all right, time out. Everybody knows what the synagogues are, right? You can have a synagogue. Matter of fact, you have to have a synagogue. Wherever you have 10 male adult Jews, you're under obligation to have a synagogue. But the synagogues were everywhere, and your whole life was built around the synagogue, the synagoge, the place, the gathering place. And this is where you went not to sacrifice. There were no sacrifice going on here, no Levitical sacrifice, but you went to read the law and to study the law. You went to find a spouse for your children. You went to find work and so on. This was everything, your synagogue. But you couldn't have a synagogue without a copy of the Torah, the five books of Moses. And you couldn't go down to Barnes & Noble and get your Torah, right? You had to have a scribe. And you would have a scribe that you would hire and pay. And, you know, I just read an article about 2 years ago that the community we lived in for a long time out in California, they had quite a well-to-do synagogue. It's been there for a lot of years, but they just got their own Torah scroll. And what they did is 20 years ago, they invested in a young man, and they sent him off to train as a Torah scribe, and he trained for several years. Meanwhile, he got married and had children, and they're totally bankrolling his life as he trained. Then for several years, he just worked at it. And you don't do it in your back room. You do it under the watchful care of an exemplar and a scribe and so on. And he copied the whole thing out. They invested somewhere between $2 and $3 million to get this Torah scroll by the time they put into it. But there was huge celebration when they had their own Torah scroll. Well, having said it, you couldn't have a synagogue without a scroll. You could, without the scrolls, without the Torah. And you couldn't have the scrolls without a scribe. And the scribes were all of a very, very Pharisaic mentality. They honored the Pharisees. Now, there's a lot I could tell you about the Pharisees, but on the other hand, they believed the entire law, and they added to it what they called the oral law, what Jesus calls the tradition of the fathers. But they were zealous. Look, how much time to spend? The Pharisees, spend some time with the Pharisees. To us, it's an insult. If I call you a Pharisee, you're not congratulated. Can I? Is that can we agree on that? To us, it's a vocabulary of insult almost. As to their genesis, the Pharisees were one of the noblest movements there ever was. They arose in the days of when there was huge corruption, and the Jews were abandoning their ways because it was inconvenient and it cost you something. And their attitude was, no matter what it costs us, no matter what price I have to pay, I am going to be loyal to God and His law. I'm going to live by the law, no matter what the Greeks, no matter what the Romans demand of me. What could be more noble? What happened was that they couldn't leave the law alone. I said to you last night that they would specify the law. And all of these tiny little specifications about what it is to keep the law, and then they became very proud of those specifications. They became more important to them than the law itself. Does that make sense to you? But little by little, the Pharisees learned to regard the law as a means of righteousness. And that's, of course, their great sin. Well, at any rate, finally, and this is huge, they were, as to their standing with the common man, they were tremendously respected and tremendously feared. They were respected because, folks, you know, this is the parallel I find, and I don't know, maybe this is, I hope this isn't hard on anybody, but it seems to me to make sense. If you can imagine some little village in some South American jungle somewhere, in the midst of that village is a little neat Roman Catholic chapel, and there's a priest assigned to that chapel. Now, to the common man in the village, if anybody is right with God, it's that priest, right? I mean, he wears a special uniform. He's very public about all of his ritual and so on. He's 24 hours a day at it. Well, that was the Pharisees. They wore special garments with blue and longer fringe and higher hats, there weren't very many of them. But they gave themselves to keeping the law, the way that a person who actually had a job and a family couldn't. Well, they might have families, but they were just, they were full-time law keepers. By the way, can I just say this? In 70 AD, the temple was destroyed. There was one sect of Judaism that survived. The Essenes disappear, the Sadducees disappear, the Herodians disappear. They're all gone. One sect survives. It's the Pharisees. They codify Pharisaic Judaism. It becomes Rabbinical Judaism. It becomes Orthodox Judaism. Hasidic Orthodoxy today is deliberately Pharisaism of the first century. It really is. You're dealing with exactly the same mentality. But I say that they were greatly revered because to the common man, they were closer to God than anybody. And by the way, they thought the same of themselves. So, Edersheim tells us that one of the titles that the Pharisees would use of themselves when they would greet one another is gatekeeper. They would, good morning, fellow gatekeeper. Because they insisted that they knew the law so well and they lived their lives so carefully according to the law that not only were they sure to get in, but God would appoint them the duty of standing at the gate and deciding who else. And well, one of them even argued that one of their number was assigned to the gate of Hades, and if God inadvertently sent somebody back there, that he could reverse the decision. So, I mean, it was to this degree that they regarded themselves as certainly right with God. And the common man tended to agree. But they were also greatly feared. And the reason they were greatly feared is because they had a punishment they could inflict upon you. Do you remember what that was? What could they do to you if they got mad at you? It's huge. Apo synagoge. It's a formal phrase. Cast you from the synagogue. Now, don't be getting tossed out of your church, okay? But this is something even bigger. This is huge. If you're tossed out of your synagogue, you're probably not going to be able to work in that community. You're probably going to have to move away. It was a hideous thing. We confront this most dramatically in the story of the man born blind in John chapter 9. They tried to get him to confess that he was never blind. He wouldn't do it. And matter of fact, I want to meet that guy. That man had chutzpah, let me tell you. But remember what he says to the Pharisees finally? He says, I used to think that my sight was the most amazing thing in my life. Even more amazing than that is your blindness. Remember he says that? I thought it was amazing I could see, but more amazing is that you can't see. But at any rate, so they tossed him out. Now, the point is, on the other hand, let's keep going here. On the other hand, the Sadducees. The Sadducees were in control of the temple. That's what, above all things, when you think of the Sadducees, there's some debate about where the name came from. But here's a little Old Testament quiz. Do you remember Eli the wicked high priest, two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, and Samuel and another man give a prophecy that there's not going to be an old man in your house. God's going to raise up a faithful priest. And when David dies, in fact, that faithful priest is put in place. It's in 2 Kings chapter 1. Do you remember his name? 1 Kings chapter 1. Yeah, remember his name? Sadjus. His name is Zadok. Remember Zadok? And to the Jewish mind, the person who had a divine right to the temple is Zadok. And this word is probably a corruption. It's Zadokite, and it became to us as Sadducee. And the point is, most of them were priests, not all of them, and not all priests by any means were Sadducees, but the elite, the aristocratic, the most wealthy, the most powerful were in charge of the temple because they had paid for it. They had gone to the Roman authorities and paid to have control of the temple. So this was a de jure issue. And of course, in order to make that worthwhile, they had to make merchandise of the people as much as they could to get their money back. Does that make sense to you? But they controlled the temple, lock, stock, and barrel. Secondly, I've got it there. They were functional unbelievers. You remember, what's the issue that you're usually talking about when the Sadducees come up in the narrative? They didn't believe in the resurrection. Now, they were horribly Grecianized, and they had this idea of some sort of a nebulous nirvana-type afterlife that was totally non-corporal and non-bodily and so on. But they denied the resurrection. Now, what kind of spiritual leader is this? You know, they don't even believe that there's a life after death. But now I'll say this, and this is going to be important in just a minute. They gave lip service. They didn't believe the Bible, but they gave lip service to the Pentateuch. They said they believed the five books of Moses. Now, they really did not, but one of those books is Leviticus, and Leviticus tells you to go to the temple and pay your tithes, and knowing where their bread was buttered, as it were, they gave lip service to the five books of Moses. But they were functional unbelievers, and most of all, they hated the common man, and the common man returned the favor. Let me do something here real quick. I don't know, I shouldn't do this, but... Yeah, right here. Here's an interesting thing. This is Jerusalem looking from the west. This area here with the red roofs, the people who built this model were very careful about this. This area up here is called the Western Hill. That's where you want to live. That's where the wealthy live because you get the Mediterranean breezes in the afternoon. And let me tell you, they're to die for. This area here is the lower city where the poor live. Up here in the Western Hill is where the priests lived. Here's an interesting thing. That area was the Jewish quarter from 1948 to 1967, during which time the Muslims controlled that city, and they devastated it. Then that area was the area where there was the most fighting in 1967. Consequently, even though this is an entirely inhabited city, that area right there could be dug. We know more about that little hill, that part of Jerusalem, than any other part, because it was available for archaeologists, and they did. Today, there's a beautiful neighborhood there, but they're all built on stilts over these archaeological digs. You can go down their basement to a big museum. You know, it's not theirs. Why don't I go back here? This right here, this long, looks like a wall, that was a private bridge. And the priests had that constructed so that they wouldn't have to soil themselves with the common man, you know, the dust of the common street. So they would go down there, and they had their own special entrance right there. And that whole thing, everything about it was just, they treated the people with absolute contempt. So, let me go back to it then. There are two times in Jesus' ministry when he cleanses the temple in Jerusalem. The first time is at the very beginning of his ministry. As I said to you the other day, there's wisdom in this. When he does, he is catapulted into notoriety. Everybody is talking about this Nazarene who had the courage to put a stop just for a little while to this Sadducean abuse that went on every year in the temple. And there was nothing that made us more mad. There was nothing that could have made us happier to see him do that. And I think as soon as he took that whip in hand, the whole temple probably erupted in support of himself. But how do you get away with it? Well, as I said to you the other day, number one, because he was so quickly and so universally the hero of the masses, his enemies, the Sadducees, he's on their turf, couldn't just spirit him away and stone him. There'd have been a riot. So in order to get rid of him, they would have to get the Romans involved. To get the Romans involved, this is exactly what's going to happen. This is how Jesus is going to die. The whole Sanhedrin has got to turn Jesus over to the Romans as a criminal. And because the Sanhedrin was almost evenly split between Pharisee and Sadducee. The Pharisees thought this was the grandest thing they'd ever seen when, in John chapter 2, the very beginning of his ministry, he cleanses the temple. See the point? So he divides his enemy, he protects himself, that's how he gets away with it. But for the next, you know, here are four Passovers in Jesus' ministry, he cleanses the temple here and here, but he leaves it alone. He evidently plugs his nose, the other two, the middle two. Meanwhile, what's he doing? Synagogue to synagogue. So now, for all of those years, he's on Pharisaic turf. And the Pharisees, you can follow it in the record, the Pharisees are getting more and more upset with him. Now, at this point, this is speculation, but I think it's very well-informed speculation, that the Pharisees must have been going to the Sadducee and brethren and saying, you know, you were right about this guy. We need him. But he's not giving it. And, you know, when it was our ox getting gorged, you were nowhere to be found. He's on the Sadducee, he's on the synagogue turf. See if we care. When Jesus cleansed the temple on Monday of the Passion Week, he was deliberately signing his own death warrant. He is galvanizing the hatred of the Sadducees. This is their territory. And the Pharisees. And he knows what he's doing. See what I'm saying to you? I think the cleansing of the temple was very deliberate. And it not only galvanized the hatred of Sadducee and Pharisee, it's going to take him 5 days to get him on a cross, but it also, once again, got the whole city talking about him. And the whole city would have made every effort to get in, because what's going to happen now? That's on Monday morning. I got 5 minutes. Well, three. Let me tell you what's going to happen the rest of the day, real quickly. I shouldn't do this, but I told you it's exciting. Jesus that evening goes back to Bethany. In the morning he comes in, and, you know, in our culture, if you want to prove you're really a man among men, what do? You know, maybe you beat everybody in the room in arm wrestling, okay? In a Jewish culture, you want to prove you're a man among men, you best your opponent in open argument. There's nothing that's more highly regarded than that. And a rabbi, above all, is one who can put his enemies to silence. Now, what's going to happen in one of the most dramatic scenes in all the Bible and all of human literature is on Tuesday, his enemies are going to come and they're going to confront Jesus in the hopes of catching him in his words. They want to do two things. They have two goals. Number one, they want to somehow derail this Jesus express. The people are following him, and they want to embarrass him somehow. But more importantly, they want him to get something that they can take to the Romans. Because above all other things, they want this man dead. But they can't do it on their own. They have to get the Romans involved. And Jesus has lived a sinless life. There's no crime he's committed. But they're trying to find some sort of a misstatement on his part. So they come, first of all, remember this, I'm going to walk very quickly, the Sadducees come. And they say, and the Bible says that he was teaching, and they stepped forward, and you can imagine all their regalia, and said, Master, we know that you're an honest man, and you don't look for favor with any man, and we have a question for you. By what authority do you do these things? Now these are the Sadducees, this is our territory. By the way, folks, if the government, and who knows what the government's going to do, and if the government decided, for some imperious reason, to shut all retail shops down the day after Thanksgiving, couldn't open until January 5th. You think that'd be hard on us? You know what I'm saying? That's what's going on here. To shut down this trade on these days is the Sadducees are beside themselves. And so they come and they say, by what authority do you do these things? Now, this they've had all night to think of this. And this is not some momentary peak. They expect and hope that Jesus will say, I am Messiah. The Bible says explicitly that Messiah comes to his temple. Malachi 3, verse 1, the messenger that comes will come suddenly to his temple. Ezekiel has him ringing the temple. So they're anxious for him to say, I am Messiah. Bingo. Susie says they're going to go straight to Pilate. This man claims to be a king. He claims to be Messiah. This is Passover. These people are following him. This man's dangerous. You better grab him and put him to death. Jesus with magisterial wisdom. And this is the way it's done. Look, can I tell you? In Israel, if you train to be a rabbi, you go to a school called a yeshiva. I worked hard at it, and I've twice gotten into a yeshiva, two different ones, one up in the West Bank and one right in Jerusalem. And the whole day, all they do, the whole room is full of podiums on two sides. And one student stands on this side and the other stands on that side, and the teacher comes in and he poses a horribly difficult, thorny question. When I listened to two guys debate all after, I didn't listen to them, but they've been at it all day and they were going at it hammer and tong. And I finally asked him, my friend had taken me to this place. You're not allowed in yeshiva, but they had come outside. So we were standing there kind of off to the side, and my friend who speaks Hebrew would ask if we could listen. And they said, yeah. And then he recognized their accent and said, would you do this in English? So I was listening to the guy. Actually, I did it in English for us. They were from Boston. But at any rate, finally I asked him, what is it? What's the question that was posed to you? By the way, they'll go at each other, hammer and tong, and then the rabbi will come in and say, okay, now switch sides. You take that side, you take that side. And then they go at it again. But the question that was posed that morning is, if a man steals a loaf of bread from his neighbor, takes a piece and puts it to his mouth, thinks better of it, takes it out and gives it back to him, has he stolen the loaf of bread? And they were going at each other, you know, calling out the Talmudic tomes and finding precedent and all this sort of stuff. Well, the fact of the matter is that Jesus was a master at that. And they were trying to catch him in his words. And so Jesus says, what I meant to say was, it's perfectly legitimate, as a matter of fact, expected that you answer with a question. So they say, by what authority do you do these things? He says, I'm going to ask you a question. The baptism of John, this is such a stroke of genius. Was it of heaven or was it of men? Now they put their heads together and they say, now wait a minute. If we say the baptism of John was of heaven, well, then he had divine authority. He announced Jesus as Messiah. Clearly he has a right to the temple if he's the Messiah. We can't say that. If we say the baptism of John was of men, these people will stone us. They love John. So now publicly they have to come back to Jesus and say, Master, we have no answer. The place would have erupted. This is just, you can't say how dramatic this is. In one, here come these men with all of their pomp and so on, and that quick Jesus puts them to silence. And then you get the is it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar from the Pharisees and the Herodians and take a coin and render to Caesar the things that are Caesar, the things that are God. And the rabbis respond by saying, Master, you've really answered well. And then the Sadducees come with their, you know, man, with this woman with the seven husbands. Remember, her husband died, given another one, he died. I always think she may have been poisoned in the soup, you know, but whatever you want with that thing. The fact, you know, in the resurrection, you know, chortle, we got you here, whose wife shall she be? And Jesus says, you do err, not knowing the scripture. Then, and remember I mentioned that the Pharisees, the Sadducees only gave lip service to the Pentateuch? It's so interesting. If I were to say to your pastor, prove the Old Testament, the resurrection of the Old Testament, that is not difficult. You can go to Job, you can go to Daniel, you can go to the Psalms. But if I were to say, prove the resurrection from the Pentateuch, think about it. That's a tough assignment. And I think Jesus decides to kind of play by their rules. And he takes them to the burning bush. And when Moses was at the burning bush, of course, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob have been in their tombs for 400, 600 years. And he says, God said to Abraham, I am the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And God is not the God of the dead, he's the God of the living. And therefore he had proven that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob continued, their life continued after death. And I love the old Luke 20, verse 40 says, after that, no man dared ask him any question at all. They'd had enough of that sport. But for Jesus to put him to silence, now listen, I've got to be done. I'm way too long. But let me just tell you this real quickly. In Matthew 23, the last time Jesus speaks publicly, and he has established throughout the day his messianic credentials, he's put his enemies to silence, he has demonstrated from Psalm 110 his messianic identity, he has argued for his right to possess this territory and so on, and now having established who he was, he stood there, and he spoke that remarkable section of curses and woes upon the Pharisees. And it is fascinating, he never mentions the Sadducees. He doesn't say, woe unto you, scribes and Sadducees. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees. Why? Because nobody wanted to be like the Sadducees. But the Pharisees, number one, they were almost universally regarded as their gospel, their message that the law was a means of righteousness, was accepted by these people, and they were regarded as working it out more perfectly than the other. And furthermore, remember this, that the Pharisees could make you pay dearly. And so Jesus stands there and he says, that long woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees. You compass land and sea to make one proselyte, and after you've made him a proselyte, he's twofold more the child of hell than you are. You know, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees. You know, I love it when he says, He says, you strain out a gnat and you swallow a camel. Folks, that's hilarious. That's hilarious. Can you imagine what would have happened on the Temple Mount as the people erupted in derisive laughter and those Pharisees are standing on there? They're there. I always say, if you really want to appreciate Matthew 23, you've got to picture Jesus pointing. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees. You hypocrites. And then he winds up by, he says, you're like so many whited sepulchres. Now that's interesting because if you brushed up against a tomb, you were impure for 40 days. And that was a problem because the tombs were just here and there on the property. And so what would happen a lot of times is you'd be making your way up to the temple for a feast and you'd just sit down in the shade and somebody, hey, I'm sorry to tell you, but you're leaning up against Grandpa's tomb. You know, there you go. So the rabbis had given this command that all the tombs be whitewashed. You just take some lime and slap it on there. And they looked nice on the outside and they glimmered in the sun. And the Temple Mount is lower than the Mount of Olives, which is covered with tombs. And I picture Jesus kind of sweeping his hand across the countryside. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees. You're like, and by the way, in the Bible, to be impure is to stink. Always take that with you. The reason God doesn't want you around him if you're impure is because you stink. You're a stench in his nostrils. And Jesus says you're like so many whited sepulchres. You look good on the outside. You glimmer in the sun. But in fact, men just rub up against you. You become a stench in God's nostrils. And when he winds up, he says, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, you brood of vipers. How can you escape the damnation of hell? Pretty much with that, he turns and leaves. Given Sunday, why Friday? The answer is Monday and Tuesday. Because what Jesus does on Monday and Tuesday is put this infinite distance between himself and the Pharisees and demand a choice. Do you see that? It's very deliberate. I like to say this, and I think probably everybody in the room is familiar with this, but I'm going to say it and we're done, I promise. I know I've been saying that for a long time, but I am done. By the way, I got to ask you one question. How many chapters are there in Philippians? 4. What's the first word in chapter 3? Anybody? Finally. work on it. But, no, I'm teasing. But here, I'm being entirely goofy. Stay with me now. Here's the point. Jesus speaks these excoriating woes upon the Pharisees, and he leaves the city with a decision. Now, when Jesus goes back to Bethany that night, his disciples are absolutely convinced the kingdom is about to come. Why, he rode into the town on Sunday and the whole city welcomed him. For the last 2 days, he has gained control of the temple and behaved more messianically than any other time in his life. And he has... But Jesus understands that he has set before this city a very clear choice. And they're going to have about 3 days to contemplate it. Early on Friday, much to their surprise, totally, totally unexpected, they are going to wake up to the news that the Nazarene is on trial for his life. As the city scurries to Caesar's, to the place where Caesar is trying him. You remember they cast their verdict. Whom would you have, Barabbas or Jesus? Give us Barabbas. Crucify Jesus. Remember that? I like to say it this way. On Sunday, as Jesus rode into the city, he made a real, sincere, bona fide offer of himself to that people as Savior. He meant it. He longed for the city to bow the knee to him. For all the world, it seemed that they did bow the knee to him. What Jesus drove home on Monday and Tuesday is simply this. You don't accept Jesus on your terms. You accept him on his terms. And his terms is, very simply is, that he is the only hope of salvation from sin. He's not going to be your Savior from Rome and not from sin. Does that make sense to you? And that lesson, that Jesus, you'll not accept Jesus on your terms. Every generation wants a Jesus of their own making, would love to fashion a Jesus that they can handle nicely and doesn't make much of a demand of them. It doesn't work. You don't take Jesus on your terms. Amen and amen? Tim, why don't you... thank you for your patience. He says presumptuously.